Thank you. First, let me say that it's a privilege and a pleasure to speak again at the Book Fair of Radical Black and Third World Books. It's been my pleasure to be here on a number of occasions, and this is clearly one of the most challenging and important occasions. Everywhere in the world, in every metropolitan city, in every campus, all points of the globe, people are talking about Malcolm X. The X, the image, the slogans are on people's heads, on their chests, on their desks, on their walls. There's a great concentration of focus and political meaning in this phenomenon, this spectacle. It's important for us to pause for a moment and think about this as an interesting point of transition, a transition from a time of peace into a time of great disorder and a focus on perhaps the most outstanding radical figure coming out of the black experience, and I might add and argue out of the American experience for the 20th century. And so it's important that we have these debates and discussions. There are many sides to this debate and discussion. I just want to share with you one news clipping that reflects a counter view of what many of us might believe. Coming from Los Angeles in December of 92, an assistant sheriff in the custody division of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office said a preliminary inquiry indicated that a white deputy, seeing an African-American deputy with a copy of the autobiography of Malcolm X, warned him that if he came to work with it again, he would defecate on it. When the black deputy brought it in the book a second time, the white deputy allegedly carried out his threat and was subsequently suspended. There's another case of a high school in the South where the black students had organized and successfully defeated the attempt by white students to parade the Confederate flag as a symbol of their cultural point of reference in high school. And then the principal took the initiative to forbid any black students from wearing any of the X symbols as the only fair thing to do. So there's a great battle going on. It's not just euphoria and support, but there's still a great battle going on. The people who opposed Malcolm X as he lived in the 1960s undoubtedly have the same position today. So we have to look at this Malcolm X the icon, Malcolm X the myth, which I think we have to view as starting with the historic eulogy that Ozzie Davis gave at the funeral, all the way up to the current symbols, that this is a permanent fixture in our contemporary political culture. But more than Malcolm, the icon and the myth, we have to, it seems to me, to fully explore the meaning and to grasp it for our own lives, is to take it from icon to paradigm, or from myth to method, both on the side of how do we understand the meaning of Malcolm X, and how do we understand that meaning in relation to our lives and continuing the struggle today. Now, in order to give some clarity and brevity to my comments, I want to try to make five brief points. First, I'd like to sketch out and review for you, as I'm sure you've seen the movie and read the autobiography, Malcolm's life. And then I'd like to try to give some way of interpreting and understanding that life by looking at the radical black tradition out of which Malcolm comes. And third, I'd like to discuss the legacy, and again make an argument for understanding the difference between what happened in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and why the 90s are different, and why when we think of the road forward, we have to understand not only the lessons of Malcolm X, but struggle to apply them within the different context in which we live today. In passing, I'd like to comment on the movie, and then to talk about some concrete points about rebuilding the struggle today in the context of the United States. We are fortunate in that Malcolm wrote an autobiography. And although autobiographies are self-reported narratives that often represent their own way of distorting or condensing or omitting facts. Nevertheless, it represents perhaps the greatest book that was produced out of the struggle in the 1960s. And it gives us a way of appropriating his life. Malcolm's life, as reported in the autobiography, has often been compared to works of great world literature and American literature, particularly the Confessions of St. Augustine and the life of Benjamin Franklin, because these two are icons of world culture, and they represent the conversion from sinner to saint, where people have lived one kind of life and through a conversion experience have become quite different, embodying the highest aspirations of their generation and of their civilization, if you will. Malcolm's life, I think, is usefully understood in four stages. I mean, clearly, all of our lives are lived in every intense moment, and yet at the same time, we all know there is a structure to our lives, just as there was a structure to Malcolm's life. And the structure of his life in four stages really enables us to look at his life as an open door, a paradigm to our broader experience. Malcolm Little, born in 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. Malcolm lived in small Midwestern towns with small black populations. And this is a very important fact because Malcolm was born outside of the South. And what was characteristic of black people, certainly up until the World War II and after that, really, until the 1960s, black people were characteristically born in the South and socialized in the cultural heritage of the agrarian tradition of the slave legacy of the South. And while that certainly influenced the political culture of the entire country, being born in the Midwest and moving into Michigan, a state characterized by the auto industry and steel and industrial production, made Malcolm much more a person whose basic experience projected him into the second half of the 20th century as opposed to the first half. So in his life as a child, we can see many things that later bloom. Born into a strong family, a mother and a father, his father an organizer for the UNIA, Garvey's organization, a Baptist preacher, his mother from Grenada, also in her own right, a leader in the UNIA. We learned from Ted Vincent's article in the Black Scholar through the research in the Negro World that she was the one who wrote the reports and wrote articles in the newspaper, so she was an independent political person in her own right. And Malcolm was the typical young brother you would want to find, high in his aspirations and his commitment to work hard. And yet, with all that in the first part of his life, what we find is that virtually every aspect that was positive was negated by the very system he had hoped to achieve within. First, his father is murdered. He reports his father was murdered by racists. Second, his mother, trying to raise her children under conditions of poverty, had a nervous breakdown and was institutionalized. The family was separated, brothers and sisters separated. Malcolm still trying to achieve, even under the conditions of living with foster homes and living with white people. And then a critical juncture occurred when the teacher, as we all read from the book, denied him that moment of optimism that all young people have in aspiring to become a professional. He wanted to be a lawyer, and the teacher said, well, you're a nigger. And as a nigger, you better maybe learn how to work with your hands, because after all, we like you and we'll give you some work. And through these experiences, Malcolm reports that he said, something died inside of me. And I, in effect, ceased to believe in the system as it had been constructed for us. And as a result of that, he eventually moves in with his paternal half-sister to Boston. Again, a significant shift. Now, not small Midwestern towns, but the second stage of his life, large Northeastern cities with large black populations, diverse, with elaborated class structures. Malcolm rejects the hypocrisy of the middle class, takes to the street. And in the street begins to lead a life exactly opposite, exactly in negation of everything his mother and his father, as he reports it, stood for. Criminal, dope dealer, money from prostitution, everything negative in our community. And in a sense, these first two stages of his life, positive and negative, really kind of lay out the whole set of options that most people in our community were experiencing when he was alive, and most of our young people experience today, either aspiring to make the system work or, on the other hand, taking to the street and being a criminal and doing exactly the opposite. Now, while we know what happens to people on the street, either you get killed or you go to prison. That's what happened to Malcolm. He went to jail. We all know this. What happened in jail? Two things happened in jail that were very important. First, an intellectual awakening, where he discovers that language and reason and words are more important than violence. And second, through his brothers and sisters, he discovers Elijah Muhammad, the Nation of Islam. And this experience really is an awakening of identity. Awakening of identity through an understanding of history, and an awakening of identity by giving Malcolm a moral discipline with which to overcome the degeneracy that he found himself living in that stage of his life. And these two lessons, the intellectual lesson and the identity lesson, essentially through two men that became surrogate fathers for him, then led to him joining the Nation of Islam, leaving prison, going to live with his brothers and sisters, and eventually living with Elijah Muhammad. Moving into the third stage of his life as Malcolm X, taking on the X as the symbol of rejection of white colonial domination through the slave experience, he becomes the national spokesperson and organizer for the Nation of Islam, based in Temple No. 7 in New York. Now, this period of his life is a period through the 50s. He leaves prison in 1952. This period of his life is very important because he's able to help transform the Nation of Islam from a small, dogmatic, religious organization that essentially had turned inward and was an organization of conservative religious dogma and discipline. He was able to take the organization out into the community as a part of the general motion of the 1950s and 60s, where the organization is reported to have grown from 400 to 40,000 or more. And Malcolm did this through his grasp not only of the lessons from Elijah Muhammad, but the street experience of the earlier experiences. Now, what I would like to argue is that in this period, what Malcolm essentially did was two things. First, he taught the black community something about history and identity. This was a dramatic struggle that was pretty much limited to northern cities, pretty much limited to those places where there was a proletarian and militant community. This was not something that spread broadly throughout the black community in the United States, this black identity. Because the dominant structure in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and early 60s was the movement that had essentially begun a century earlier with the emancipation experience. The fight led by the black middle class to integrate black people into the structures of American society. Malcolm represented the response of the working class black community that had not been included in that motion and was not being included in the motion even under conditions of great victory. In addition, Malcolm was beginning to preach and to talk about unity, but unity that far extended beyond the civil rights movement. Now here what I would like to do is to bring in this notion of the radical black tradition, because I think this is the only way to understand the twists and turns of Malcolm X. Now from my reading of black history, there are essentially five aspects of this radical black tradition: religion, Pan-Africanism, nationalism, feminism, and socialism. Most of these elements were very much a part of Malcolm's upbringing with his father and his mother coming out of the UNIA. This was the self-determination debate that Garvey had participated in, Booker T. Washington had participated in, W.B. Du Bois had participated in. This was a debate where black people were in essentially the rural South and were fighting to determine the future and organization of the black community, but in no way were raising questions about the transformation of the entire United States. It wasn't until the 1940s, with the mechanization of southern agriculture and the massive migration of black people from the rural South into the urban North, that black people now in the industrial context became a factor in the fundamental organization of the main features of the US economy. And it was in this period that when the civil rights movement was essentially successful, at least at the nominal level of legislation that broke down the barriers of segregation, essentially in the South, and unleashed the massive forces in the 1960s, that we get a transformation from the fight for integration to the fight for social and economic justice. And it's in this context that when Malcolm X started talking about identity and started talking about struggle and started talking about from the bottom up and started talking about the economic and political equity for black people in the urban areas and throughout the world, that we see a tremendous transformation in his thinking. What Malcolm started talking about, even before he left the Nation of Islam, was the transformation from being a religious zealot to being a political revolutionary. And this, I would argue, was the main reason why the tensions emerged in the Nation of Islam and led to Malcolm leaving the Nation of Islam. There are several points, I think, that are important to make here. First, Malcolm X had clarity around the concept of revolution. And when he talked about revolution, he talked about it in terms of land and bloodshed. Now, it's important for us to understand what he meant by these two concepts. When he talked about land, he was talking about it in relationship to the examples he used, which were the national liberation struggles, principally Cuba, China, and Vietnam. What he was talking about was political economy, the fight of a people to take control of the economy and to reorganize it and develop it in their own interests. He saw that as a fundamental objective of revolution. And the second aspect that he talked about, bloodshed, was again in those examples, the use of armed struggle as the strategic weapon to take control of society and to defeat the state structure of the oppressive force that which they were opposing. And here, I think what he's talking about is principally the notion that later was summed up in the phrase, by any means necessary. Because consistently when he talked about violence, he talked about violence in terms of self-defense. And he talked about having to respond to the conditions under which you faced your struggle. And he put it in so many ways, that the point is that it was a question of reciprocity. It was a question of doing whatever you had to do to be free. And by any means necessary meant exactly that. And it's important to stress that, as we all know, because not so much now, but then, the principal criticism of Malcolm was that he advocated violence, when in point of fact, consistently, he advocated self-defense. Now, in addition to talking about revolution, what he was talking about is united front politics. Now, this is very important because what happened as a result of Malcolm becoming involved in the Black Liberation Movement through discussions with, particularly in Harlem, in New York, because Malcolm was transformed in the context of the political culture of Harlem, and it was there that he moved from the isolation in the Nation of Islam to the broader, comprehensive revolutionary thinker that he became. It was there that Malcolm began to initiate new concepts that were very much different from what was being discussed in the Nation of Islam, even before he left the Nation of Islam. One of the major examples is the idea of identity. Elijah Muhammad had always argued that black people were Asiatic, seeing the world now divided between East and West. It was Malcolm, as a result of struggle on the streets of Harlem, with the Garveyite movement, with the African Pioneer Nationalist movement, that he began to advocate the concept of Africa. And in moving identity away from purely an ideological formulation to a political formulation, to an actual discussion of the concrete politics, and therefore when we remember Malcolm, we remember discussions of Ghana, of Lumumba in the Congo, of South Africa, of East Africa, of the OAU. I mean, there's concrete political discussions about Africa. Now, I think these are the reasons why the split occurred in the context of the broad movement, as opposed to the particular issues that came up that separated Malcolm from Elijah Muhammad, but we can talk about that later. What I want to get to is that when Malcolm did break in the last year and a half, he spent as a person without the context of the Nation of Islam, even trying to develop these two fledgling organizations, Muslim Mosque Incorporated and the Organization of Afro-American Unity, we have to understand Malcolm in transition. And I want to emphasize that because as a person who was a political speaker, a spokesperson, not a systematic writer of ideas. I think it's pretty impossible to try to develop a systematic summation of a full ideological position. I don't think this is the way to characterize Malcolm X, although the many ways that people today try to appropriate Malcolm X to their fully developed ideological position, I think does represent, in effect, a distortion of Malcolm's views. What we can learn from Malcolm is that these ideas he was putting forward were definitive in the middle 1960s. Black identity, the question of revolution, the question of identification with third world revolutionary movements, the concept of self-defense as a transformation from the civil rights nonviolent movement to the question of armed struggle as an option within the American scene. And I think that the way to understand it is not so much to try to appropriate Malcolm to today, but let's look at what actually happened after he was assassinated in February 1965. What actually happened? In August of 1965, the Watts Rebellion occurred. And in the Watts Rebellion, what we had was a radical redefinition of the entire 60s from being essentially located in the South around nonviolent integration to the North with a new social force on the scene, urban proletarian youth, who were arguing that they were not a part of the American dream, but rather were fighting against the American nightmare that Malcolm spoke about. And as a result of this social revolt in Los Angeles, the next year, the emergence of Black Power as a concept put forward by SNCC in Mississippi then leads to October of 1966, the Black Panther Party being formed. And it's in this transformation toward Black Power that really Malcolm becomes a historical force in the Black liberation movement. Because up to this point, it was a small group of people who were gradually won publicly to Malcolm's position, although because Malcolm was in the media, large numbers of people supported his position, but we don't know about that because people are watching television and reading the newspapers. All of the survey data doesn't indicate that at all. And since they weren't on the demonstration, they weren't coming to listen to Malcolm in forums like this, we don't know. That's the fact of the matter. But what we do know is that after 1966, I can point out a number of organizations that really embody Malcolm X. First, the Black Panther Party. Second, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, founded in Detroit. And third, the African Liberation Support Committee. The Black Panther Party was formed by a group of proletarian youth in California, and it rapidly spread throughout the United States. The direct confrontation with the police. The police at this point in American cities were led by white people, predominantly white police in the black community, and hostile relations with the majority of black youth. And the Panther Party was an organization that directly confronted that. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers was a militant black caucus movement within the unions, because at that time all the unions were white and all the management in the corporations, particularly the auto plants, but all the other corporations were white. And this was a group of militant black workers that organized to confront that. And the African Liberation Support Committee was an organization that formed as a militant organization to go beyond the notion of changing the public policy and the foreign aid orientation of the United States government to actively work with and organize to directly support the armed struggle of groups fighting for liberation in Southern Africa and Guinea-Bissau. Now, what happened as a result of this Black Power initiative, which was Malcolm's initiative, is that two things occurred. First, most of these struggles, though apparently defeated, actually were quite successful. We have to link the development of the Black Panther Party's confrontations with police with the fact that today, in all the big cities, you have black police chiefs, large numbers of black policemen in the black community. Their objective with regard to the police was actually accomplished. In terms of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, the fact of the matter is that today, in virtually all of the unions where black people have large numbers of workers, the union leadership has incorporated black leadership. In addition, management now increasingly includes black people, which is really the story of the 1970s and 1980s. Because while there was a great deal of repression of revolutionary youth, what actually happened is that the black middle class in the 1960s expanded in an unprecedented way and moved inside of the state structures, inside of the corporate structures, though more in the public sector than the private sector. But the fact of the matter is that the objective of integration to some very minimal extent was successful. But on the other hand, what actually happened is that the class polarization intensified and conditions facing the majority of black people got worse, not better. So the 70s and 80s, while representing a kind of electoral parliamentary road in which black mayors were voted for and eventually even a black governor, the fact of the matter is that the conditions facing black people got worse and worse. But it wasn't just a quantitative thing, it was a qualitative thing. Because by the time of the 1970s, we didn't have the same kind of economic conditions that had existed in the 60s. Because in the 1960s, when Malcolm said he saw a nightmare, not an American dream, in retrospect, we can begin to talk about the nightmare actually existing today. Because in the 1968 period, when the League of Revolutionary Black Workers was organizing in Detroit, you could struggle in a plant and get fired in the morning and be hired that afternoon in another plant. There was an expansion of the U.S. economy, not a contraction. Today, you get fired in the morning. You ain't hardly gonna get a job by the afternoon. I believe that's probably what it's like in London. The point is that in retrospect, in the 1990s, we see this as the real nightmare that Malcolm was talking about. And therefore, to talk about Malcolm X today is to talk about a world that appears to be much more in keeping and in line with what he was talking about. But there's even more to it than that, because the economic revolution is not only preventing black people from having any dreams that connect up with reality, but it's extending to where we now have generations of people who know they have no stake in American society more than at any other time in American history. And secondly, the contradiction is so deep that it now extends to include Latinos and white people. And that represents something new, unprecedented, and one has to go back to the time, at the time of the Civil War to find examples like this, maybe the Great Depression. So the example is, in 1992, April, May, there's another revolt in Los Angeles. In 1965, when the Watts Revolt occurred, central Los Angeles was all black. The revolt was a black revolt, and it was within the black community. In 1992, after the Rodney King case led to the verdict of not guilty, not only did the revolt far expand beyond the area of South Central Los Angeles, but the fact of the matter is that half the people that now live in South Central Los Angeles are Latino. And of them, the majority are undocumented workers from Central America, like El Salvador. There, because of the role of the U.S. Imperialist aid, legal and illegal, to fascist regimes there, creating the necessity for people to be economic and political refugees in the United States. And so that in 1965, when the black middle class could put signs up that said, "Soul Brother, black owned," in 1992, when those signs were put up, it didn't mean a damn thing, because some of the people who were speaking Spanish didn't even understand the signs that they were being put up. That the class contradiction becomes much more severe and much more at the center of the politics of today, which is the real context for understanding the emergence of Malcolm X. Because the emergence of Malcolm X, as he would put it, is the emergence of a voice of the bottom of the pile Negroes, of the field Negroes. And the conditions of that class reality are increasingly being shared by not only the majority of black youth, whose conditions of life are much like the peripheral third world, I'm talking 40 and 50 and 60% unemployment, permanent unemployment, but I'm talking about the struggle for survival, The statistics and the experience are mind-boggling. And for those of you who don't know, we can, in the Q&A, we can get into some of the discussions of just how horrendous it is. Now, it's in this context that we have to look at the rise of Malcolm X and try to come to some understanding of what's going on. The revolutionary generation, from my perspective, has put forward a cultural initiative through rap music. And Malcolm becomes an icon and a point of reference within this. And it seems to me that it's important to see this as a first step. It's also important to see this in the context of a great debate that's going on. Is Malcolm to be connected to the militant struggle that would then also refer to the Black Panther Party and other examples of mass mobilization and direct confrontation with the state? Or is Malcolm a reference point that leads to Minister Farrakhan and other examples of essentially a political retreat into the religious dogmatism and internal conservatism of Elijah Muhammad? There's a debate going on in rap music and hip-hop culture, and the youth are carrying it out, and we're witnessing it. But there are other initiatives as well, one of the initiatives being the movie by Spike Lee. If the movie would be a bridge to people reading Malcolm and taking up the struggle that Malcolm initiated and carrying out the struggle in the context of today's worsening economic conditions, it would be one thing. Whatever the shortcomings of the movie, we would forget those shortcomings because the movie would have played a great historical role. On the other hand, if that doesn't happen and if the movie becomes a substitute for that, then it seems to me we have to severely criticize the movie on its own merits. And it seems to me very clear that the movie gives us a discussion of racism and a militant anti-racist position. It gives us religion and Malcolm's conversion while on the Hajj to Mecca and converting to Sunni Islam. But what it does not give us is Malcolm's radicalism. The example, of course, is that when the CIA is kind of Keystone Cops, where there's no explanation as to why they're there, peering over sand dunes while Malcolm is observing the pyramids, the question is, why are they there? But we don't see Malcolm meeting with Fidel. We don't see Malcolm calling for Che Guevara. We don't see Malcolm talking about revolution. In fact, revolution comes up in the credits when Arrested Development is doing their tune. The point is that at every point, there is distortion and an interpretation that only leads to a conservative interpretation of Malcolm X. Just a couple of quick points. I mean, Malcolm connected not with Nelson Mandela as much as with Stephen Biko and the Black Consciousness Movement. In fact, even when Mandela read the quote, he refused to read the last lines by any means necessary. I think the Mandela that formed the spirit of the nation might well have read the full quote. But the point is, even more than that, it was when the school children said, I am Malcolm X, right? That's, of course, our hearts went out to them, but the fact of the matter is they could not be Malcolm X. They could well have said, I will study and sacrifice and become a revolutionary, willing to live and die for my people, and then I'll be like Malcolm X. That would, of course, been closer to the truth, and it would have been much more dangerous, and it would have been much more challenging, because then to leave the theater, you would have had an agenda. But if just to declare yourself Malcolm X makes you Malcolm X, then to put a hat on is sufficient. Now, of course, the movie ends, and it's interesting, this is not true with the film, I believe that's shown here, but in the United States, the film ends with a series of personality portraits of the Black millionaires that gave him some money. You know, and the last person you see is Dr. Huxtable. Now, of course, this has something to do with Spike Lee's agenda, but we have to look at it in terms of this being associated with Malcolm X. He had an opportunity to make a great movie, and he didn't do it. Now, we're faced with trying to sum up Malcolm and what are the lessons that we have to apply to ourselves today, and I'd like to suggest three things. First, I'd like to suggest that, if anything, Malcolm's life stood for politics and not ideology. That is to say, while certainly in his conversion to the Nation of Islam, he was explicitly ideological. He was a dogmatist, a zealot, a convert. And yet from that point when he became minister of Temple No. 7 until the time he died, what you got was a fantastic experience of Malcolm as a person relating to other people, as a political speaker, interacting with all the movements that he interacted with, reading voraciously, and constantly dynamically changing his views. Where what became the principle of change and transformation was his involvement in the political struggles of his era, and not simply reproducing dogmatic ideology. So it's politics over ideology. The second point is that Malcolm always had a clear class perspective. He always insisted that his view was from the bottom up. He always consistently identified with the people who were most exploited and most oppressed. And third, and perhaps most important of all, when Malcolm talked about unity, Malcolm always insisted that it was unity of action. That it wasn't a question of one's ideological beliefs. There was no ideological litmus test, particularly at the end of his life, that he was mainly talking about. What he was talking about was, if you look at the concrete problems that black people face, it was, in point of fact, our unity and struggle to transform the actual material world and use that as the basis for building black unity. And he would, I think, have argued, building unity with everyone else who shared common views and beliefs. And it's in this way, I think, that Malcolm escaped the narrow ideological confines of his origins in the Nation of Islam and became the worldwide revolutionary that people all over the world cherish and use as a point of reference for how we have to transform ourselves and build the future. Thank you.